Okay, very good. Okay, so we can start then. This session is usually just the first talk, a little bit of some instructions, and the first is to try and keep the noble silence if you possibly can, and hopefully you know what the noble silence means. The noble silence is not just not talking at all, it's just restricting the talk only to maybe a sentence here and a sentence there. So if somebody is looking for where the toilets are, you don't need to try and just mime or whatever. Just tell them, toilets over there. But don't get into a discussion about the benefits of toilets and just how a real meditator, they know how to go to the toilet. They don't even call it a toilet. In our tradition, we call it letting go room. Well, that's true, that's what you do there. And how do you actually to go to a toilet, do letting go? You don't force. You're mindful and you're kind, and then you find you let go much easier. But if you force something, you tend to get sick. So please don't force anything. There's plenty of toilets here. If the toilets get too many people, that'll be a sign you're eating too much. So don't do that. So in other words, if they need to say something, just say it, but don't talk too much. It's amazing when you do have a silent retreat, even when you don't talk much to each other, because what that actually does, it means the mind settles down as well, and the mind, the brain is not thinking too much. And, you know, personally, because I've been a monk for such a long time, I do talk too much, and I just almost resent that, because I have to talk. It's not negativity like resentment, but I look at you, and you're so lucky. You don't have to say anything. You just sit there, the food is served to you, you know where your room is, you know where the toilets are. You don't have to do anything, even asking a question. You don't need to speak, you just write it down on the piece of paper and you answer the best you possibly can. So it's nice when you can keep that silence. And what I've always found is when I keep silence, my mindfulness increases. In other words, I'm not just looking at descriptions in my mind, I'm looking at the reality of what is actually going on there. And please, I'll get this out of the way, because this is a story I just remember first time I saw it. It explained the meaning of silence and why silence is so important, especially if you're going to meditate, if you're interested in the truth of things, and also if you want to appreciate the world much more. And that's the old story of Lao Tzu walking through the forest with an attendant. The rule was the attendant had to keep quiet. He wasn't allowed to speak or say anything. And when they got to a ridge in the mountains, a beautiful sunset was happening. And it was so gorgeous that the attendant forgot, you know, what the rule was and said, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset that is." Now, of course, if the attendant or if the master had said, "You know, you've broken your rule of silence," then the attendant would actually say, "Well, so have you." And that wouldn't work. So the master just turned around, walked back to monastery. And only when he got back to monastery did he say, "From now on, that attendant can't go on a walk with me ever again." Why? And the reason was because you broke the noble silence rule. What's wrong with that? I mean, what's evil about just saying what a beautiful sunset? It was a beautiful sunset. Why can't you say that? And that's when the master said, when he said what a beautiful sunset, he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was just watching the words. I don't know how that affects you, but the first time I heard that, wow, it explained it to me. When you're thinking, you're not actually seeing. You're not actually experiencing reality. You're experiencing what thinking is like. And thinking is never accurate. That's why we have all sorts of arguments about thoughts. We have all sorts of different types of Buddhism, all about thoughts. We have all sorts of different dissertations and books about thoughts. But reality is basically almost indescribable. And this is one of the differences. I don't know, this story comes up. I don't know if any of you were there at Dhammasara when I did this little instruction, because sometimes people heard so many instructions, so many words, so many books. But that you asked me, I think I was just going over there for some ceremony. It could have been a committee meeting or something. And then you said, Ajahn Brahm, can you please give us some Dhamma talk before you go? I said, OK, I'll give you a short one. But I need to go to the toilet, first of all. So I asked you, where's the toilet? And they said, over there. Look, I already knew where that toilet was. You know, I'd sort of helped design that, sort of the nun's cottage. I knew where the toilet was. He said, it's over there. And I said, oh, thank you. And so I went to the door. They had actually men's toilet written on the outside. So I never actually did this. I'm a very restrained monk. I just pretended to urinate on the door. And I said, what are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? You're crazy enough as it is. I said, this is where the toilet is. It says on there, it's got the sign on there, men's toilet. That's where I'm supposed to go, isn't it? I don't know if you've actually changed it since, but you should actually put men's toilet inside. Because, but anyhow, it's just showing just how thoughts, labels and signs, they're approximations. They can't tell the full picture. They just give you instructions. Any sensible person, and I try not to be sensible all the time, maybe sometimes, but you say, well, that's what it says, men's toilet, so that's where I'm supposed to go, isn't it? So this is one of the problems with signs and thoughts and words. They never actually capture the truth. They're just pointing a little bit away from it, which is one of the reasons why the silence, you get so much more wisdom from silence, more peace, more joy, more truth from silence. So in order to encourage that silence, no, please be silent together. If there's nothing really to say, then don't say anything. If you wonder, that's one of the reasons, why we, I'm being honest here, why we instituted some chanting every day. Only so you can still use your vocal cords. Otherwise, just imagine you don't say anything for 7, 8, 9 days. You don't know whether you can speak again afterwards. So you can have the chanting and you can give it sort of full power, rah, 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 in order to keep the vocal cords well oiled. But other than that, and see what the world is like when you don't talk, when you don't think. And if somebody else does talk, and they're, you know, very talkative, some people are like that. It's not nothing wrong with them, it's just their habit. They're used to talking. They think that's the only way to be friendly. So if somebody talks too much, what do? You give them the one finger sign. Not that one finger sign, this one. So people, what are you thinking? Crikey. So give them one finger sign. But that's all you need to do, just to remind them, just to be quiet. If there really is something to say, fine. It may be your partner's here, there may be some difficulty or someone is making a mistake, they get things wrong. That's fine, just to give them some nice advice. But don't, you know, go that far, you go into a conversation. And, you know, number two is that even though you don't talk to one another and don't say, good morning, how are you, sometimes we feel we have to do that just to be friendly to one another. You don't need to say anything, but you can always smile. There's nothing wrong in it. It's actually wonderful just to smile at one another as you pass one another. But no need to break into speech. I know there was this, one of the suttas, which you know, I love. It's got some very deep teachings about nimittas afterwards, but it starts off just with these three monks who were living together. And they knew exactly what needed to be done, just went on arms round, they set out the place where they had to put some water out, sweep it. They never needed to say anything, simply because they knew what needed to be done. And if somebody needed help moving a jar of water, they just look at each other and then they help each other. And they lived actually in silence. And only one day, once every 3 or 4 days, did they have a talk together, chat about the meditation, about the Dhamma. Other than that, they were silent for days. And then the Buddha came to visit them. And when the Buddha came to visit them, the Buddha said, how are you doing? And they explained just how they were practicing. No speech, and just helping each other out, keeping the place clean, washing up, after the one meal of the day. And they said, how's your meditation going? And they said, we get some really nice deep meditation. And the Buddha said, I asked that question, but I knew if you live like that with such restraint and not thinking and making speech, of course your mind becomes very quiet. And it's natural you get deep meditation. It's nothing about your abilities or lack of abilities. It's just the ability, just the practice of sense restraint and not speaking. And honestly, how much do you need to speak on this retreat? Those people have got their duties to be done, like cutting up vegetables or something in the kitchen. Just be mindful, be aware, and if somebody needs something to be cut up, then help them. You don't need to have a conversation about what's the best way to cut up a carrot. It's amazing what people have conversations about, all stupid stuff. It's not really meaningful, it's just something to say, because we get a bit bored. Yes, it's not usual for you to have such silence, but after a day or two, you get so used to it. In old retreats, we used to keep this rule very strictly to try and keep quiet. And just as almost like an experiment, or maybe it was an experiment, or just as a teaching, a practical teaching. I think one day before we were finishing, I said, the following morning we're going to be packing up and getting everything ready, so you'll be talking. But I wanted to end the noble silence a day earlier. So the day earlier, say on a Saturday, if you're going to leave on Sunday, you can always start speaking to each other now. No one did. They liked the silence. It was almost to prove to them that silence is beautiful. Why break it? So everyone just kept on being silent. And it's not just that it's a beautiful abiding, it's peaceful. You'd be able to see much more when you're not talking to somebody else, or you're not thinking, all sorts of fantasies or plans or dreams or whatever. When you're walking out from this hall, it's amazing what you experience. I know it's a bit cold, but if it's during the middle of the day, maybe just, I might get into trouble with this, come in here not wearing any shoes. Walk from your hut to here without shoes. Don't wear socks. Feel the concrete path. Feel just the transition to the concrete, just on the, or the, not the concrete, sorry, the bamboo floor. What does a bamboo floor feel like? It's not just nothing, but get to know it, get to feel it. When you go inside your room, what does that feel like? You become much more mindful, and it stops you thinking. There's so much going on. If it is cold, it's a wind Feel the wind across your face. What does it feel like? So you become much closer to nature, to the real world. And I say that carefully, the real world. And I'll warn you, at the end of the retreat, people always ask the question, what do I do when I go back to the real world? And I keep saying, you are in the real world here. You go back into the fake world, where you have to wear makeup, funny clothes, and wear shoes and protect yourself. And I don't know, is it really real? Which is more real, here or out there? When you have to think and there's always music or commentary going on. It's really noisy in that outside world. But here you can have silence and get much, much closer to reality. So this is, and I welcome you to the real world here. And after a while, you're not afraid of it. You get used to it, and it's far more beautiful, so much more peaceful, and you see so much more during the daytime. So it's a beautiful day today in the afternoon. Sometimes you can just go and stand outside and just see the sky and the birds flying in the, between the trees, or just see the trees and hear everything which is going on here. I don't mean just the sound of people making the lunch for you or cleaning up. The sound of the birds, the sound of the wind, the sound of the trees rustling. You can only do that when you have silence. And if it has been a warm day, I think it probably would have worked today, but it seems a little bit cold today. One lovely thing to do after the evening talk is actually go out onto the stupa. Just lay down on the stupa. Because those stones have been absorbing the heat of the day, it's quite comfortable. And if it's a clear evening, you can watch the stars. And absolutely gorgeous. Because there's such a clear sky here. There's very little light pollution. You just look up and just see the whole Milky Way. And you feel comfortable. What you're doing there, you can't think anything or say anything, just experience that in silence. I think many of you know that before I was a monk, I was a theoretical physicist, and actually knew most of the names of those stars in the sky. That was also part of the Astronomical Society. I remember just having wonderful experiences of going out into, in Cambridge, and to one of these old observatories. I think it's actually where they first found or saw Pluto. It was discovered in that particular observatory. And because those observatories, that was such a long time ago, had been surpassed by like these amazing telescopes they put in orbit around the Earth, the students were allowed to play with it. And so I remember just going out there in the evening and sitting in the chair and putting your eye into this huge barrel telescope and seeing Saturn. Just the real one, not sort of photo, but actually seeing it live. And that just was amazing. Yeah, I'd seen sort of Saturn with its rings before, but actually being there and seeing it through a telescope yourself, it was sad, it was real. And so it's stuff like that made me just so appreciative of silence. But at the same time, I was told and learned many of the names of the stars and constellations and what they were and how far they were away and whether they were a star or a galaxy or what they were. And that spoiled so much. So I deliberately forgot the names of the stars, so I could see them like you can see them, just as beautiful dots of light scattered in the night sky, such a long way away but still visible. You can only do that in silence. So that's one of the reasons why in silence you can see so much more beauty in the nature in Jhana Grove. It's a peaceful, quiet place. Not only that, for those of you who are much more sensual, when you go for silence, the food tastes more delicious. You don't have much food here, just breakfast and lunches, although in the afternoon. What do they serve in the afternoon here? Anything? Chocolate or cups of tea and stuff?
Cheese.
Cheese, yeah. But honestly, what happens when you get mindful and silence? You don't just call it cheese. You just put something in your mouth and it tastes amazing. I'm not really a connoisseur of food. Sometimes people look at my diet and said, how can you eat that, Ajahn Brahm? But nevertheless, I eat it. But this is one of those stories that one day after doing my own personal retreat, I usually do a couple of weeks during the rains retreat, just stay in my cave and just people come and bring food to me. But just afterwards, the first breakfast I had after my retreat, the baked bean story. They had a plate there. I don't choose the food, it just someone comes up and gives it to me. And they had one baked bean. It's my first breakfast after my, I think, 2-week retreat. And I just put one baked bean on my tongue and put it in my mouth. Wow. That's what I thought. I'm not exaggerating. Wow, this baked bean, the taste of it. Have you ever tasted a baked bean after you've been on retreat for 2 weeks by yourself? It was a taste sensation, an explosion of this tomato paste on the outside of the baked bean. It wasn't too astringent, it wasn't too sweet, it wasn't too anything. It was just perfect, a perfect balance of like tomatoes and whatever else they put in there. And I was just tasting that thing. Wow, wow, wow. It was like I thought that baked bean had been made by like Jamie Oliver or something. I found out afterwards it was by Heinz, out of a can. But nevertheless, when I squashed the bean between my teeth, the texture of that bean was something incredible. It wasn't too hard, not too soft. It was almost perfect. I don't know how they managed to, well, they tested the texture of the bean with the baking and they managed just to do it exactly to the second or to the millisecond, not too much baking, not too little baking. So it just came out just like a perfect baked bean. And that was almost enough for the whole day. It's like a taste explosion in my mouth. I did eat some more afterwards. Well, it was surprising just, you know, with the silence and the mindfulness, just how even food tastes much more beautiful and tasty than you've ever had before. And people keep thinking, oh, we must have the best cooks in the world come to Jhana Grove. It's nothing to do with the cooks. It's everything to do with you. It's your taste. Your taste has been like freed, burnished, made so pure, so you can pick up all the tastes which are there. That's amazing. A similar story that up Kingsbury Drive, you know, from the Southwest Highway, I'm sure most of you came that way, from the Southwest Highway up Kingsbury Drive, it's about 2.2 kilometres up that hill. That's the normal way that people come to Bodhinyana Monastery and also to Jhana Grove. Except, I think some of the retreat managers can understand this story. Except that one day, about this time, we had a lady come to Bodhinyana Monastery and you know, she wasn't expected to come. You know, and you could see, I knew who she was. She shaved her hair and put on white clothes because she said Ajahn Brahm called her on the psychic plane to come and spend the rains here. I didn't know such thing, but she also had the band from Bentley Mental Hospital around her wrist. And the poor thing was a bit psychotic. But nevertheless, you know, you were stuck with her for a couple of hours. So we called a psychiatric emergency team, they came. But then while we were waiting for them to arrive, and she had a cup of tea, when I said she can't stay here, she threw the cup of tea at me. She missed. I thought, what a waste of tea. But nevertheless, because of that, when the pet team arrived, she said, has she been violent? I said, well, she threw a cup of tea at me. She missed. She's not a good shot. I said, oh, we can't go and see her yet without the police being here. So we had to call up the police from the Armadale place. They didn't have a police station in Mundijong then. And you'd think the police would know better. It took them a couple of hours to get here. So why were you so late? They came by a serpentine dam. Even they got lost. So, yeah, sometimes they come that way as well. And I don't know these days. But anyway, it all worked out in the end anyway. But most people come up, you know, from Southwest Highway, just 2 or 3 kilometres from the highway to up here. So one day, when I used to be much younger, much thinner and much fitter, it was a beautiful morning and I asked the person who was driving me back from somewhere, please let me out at the bottom of the hill, I want to walk up. Honestly, you don't know how hard that is for me to get permission to walk up that hill. Everyone says I should have exercise, but you don't let me. I say, no, you can't do that. We'll take you up. But this time I was firmer. I got out of the car and walked up that hill by myself. And this was, I think I remember, about 7 or 8 years I was in this monastery when I did this. One thing which I noticed, which I will never forget, as I was walking up that hill, what I saw was so different than anything I could remember seeing through the window of a car. It's kind of like I was lost. The hillside looked different. And even the little stream in the bottom of the valley looked different. Everything looked totally strange, and I thought, what's going on here? I've been living in this place 7 years at the time, going up and down the hill in a car 3 or 4 times a week, probably much more than that. I thought I remembered where I lived. But when you went walking instead of seeing it through the window of a car, it looked very, very different. So what I did, just kind of automatically, you know, what's going on, I stopped. When I stopped and just stared without moving at all, then it changed again. You could see so many blades of grass on the hillside going down to the bottom of the valley. You could see all the lichen on the trees and on the rocks as well. You see the different types of trees, they had different types of barks, and just the way that some were bent one way, some were bent the other way. And just the hillside, it wasn't just smooth. It had all the rocks and the valleys, just within the hillside. It had contours. It wasn't smooth. You saw so much detail there. What you saw was so much more beautiful and satisfying. And it kind of shocked me. Because I was a scientist before, I wanted to find a science solution. I found one. How do your eyes work? When you see something, the light goes to the retina, and then there's a chemical reaction happens in your retina, and then the signals go to your brain. But when you're looking through the window of a speeding car, it wasn't really speeding, 30, 40, 50 kilometers an hour, that's all. When you're looking through the window of a car, the light hits your eye and the retina, and then after a while, after such a short while, another image comes in, and another image comes in, another image comes in. There's not one image has a chance to fully form. So you miss all the detail. And the colours are like watercolours. They're washed out. They don't have a time to actually to form properly. When you get out and walk, it has much more time. You see, the images in your retina are more fully formed. But nothing beats being still. Because when you're perfectly still, your retina has all the time it needs to form a perfect image with all the colours, you know, rich, full. Always remember that, and remember this is a great simile for stillness and meditation, for silence, not moving. You see so much more and it looks so much more beautiful. What I'm saying is you start to enjoy this place much more. Is it a beautiful place? You ain't seen nothing yet. It's going to get so much more beautiful if you have the stillness, the softness and the silence to be able just to, as you're walking back sometimes, you just stop. You notice things and it's absolutely beautiful. That's what happens with meditation. That's why this is something to look forward to. If you're going to look forward to anything, this meditation works and it makes you so much more joyful and peaceful and happy. You have a wonderful time. If you don't, then I'm a bad teacher. That's what's on offer. So how do you do that? How do you be silent? Don't talk. It's more than that. This was based on a talk I gave on Wednesday on sense restraints. What actually is sense restraints? If you actually read some of the teachings of the Buddha, you see a lot of that sense restraints. But what actually is it? What happens is the silence, the peace, the stillness, and the joy of that gets so strong. You appreciate that more than anything else. I've been meditating a long time now, over 50 years. Yes, 49 years as a monk, for goodness sake. So I know my meditation. I'm addicted to it. I don't mind saying that. I love it. It's joyful. It's the best thing you can ever do. Even as a senior monk administrator, you do have lots of problems to settle, difficulties to solve, decisions to make. And a couple of nights ago, just so much was going on. It's almost driving you crazy. But I told the monks that then you just went back to your room, you brushed your teeth, you went into your cave and sat down and meditated. It's like a different world you live in meditation. And all those problems and difficulties of the world, that's my life outside my cave. Inside my cave, I just let go and be peaceful and be still. It actually works. You can let everything go and be really peaceful. Otherwise, you know, probably have heart attacks and stuff. But that keeps me alive. And of course, you want to share that with everybody, the peace and the stillness inside. And it's joyful, it's happy. So once you have those experiences of the stillness and the joy of that stillness inside, the peace, the silence, you become quite protective of it. You can actually let it go to serve others, but when you have the opportunities, you get squash your legs or do whatever it is you need to allow the body to relax, and just the mind just goes towards that stillness and silence. It's just like a sort of like a man, a young man sees a beautiful woman. Or just like the other day at Dhammaloka Center, that I was about to leave to come back to Bodhinyana Monastery after the weekend on a Sunday afternoon. And then somebody said, oh, you've got to wait for a few minutes. There's somebody is visiting and they want to sort of pay respects to you. So who is it? And it was a couple of Bollywood film stars. And when I heard that, I said, oh, we've got to wait for a few minutes. A couple of Bollywood film stars want to come and say hello. It's amazing how many other people decided they will stop as well to see Bollywood film stars. It's crazy. But nevertheless, why? Because you these are members of our Buddhist society, not the monks. They really wanted, you know, to see something what was attractive. I remember there was quite a few Thai people there and they asked me, is he married? Is he married? Yeah, he is. But anyhow, That's what your mind is like. It will always seek for what you find happiness, joy and peace in. So once you know the quietness, the silence of the mind, wow, your mind will incline towards that so easily. It's just this phrase which the Buddha kept on saying, your mind leaps towards it. See something that's gorgeous and beautiful, and there it's for you. You just, of course you go there. It attracts you in. That's why when you know what silence is, why do you want to speak? Why do you want to think? You know much more. You get much closer to the truth when your mind is silent. Now, you, as many of you have been to my retreats before, you've heard me so many times before. Sometimes on the first talk, they want instructions on how to meditate. That's what I've been doing. Not that, do this, and once you've done that, do that, and after you do that, do something else. That's not what meditation is like. Some people try that and they get a bit frustrated. And they give so many steps, like the 16 steps of Anapanasati. Is that all the steps there are? No, there's the preliminaries as well before then. And after the retreat, people say, what stage are you on? I'm on stage 4. Stage 4, I got that the first day. I'm on stage 6 now. Stage 6, that's hopeless. You can see the silly stuff which happens when you start having stages. But stillness. How can you compare stillness? It stops all of those silly thoughts. When it stops those silly thoughts, it stops your striving and effort. This is a weird thing. People say, Ajahn Brahm, surely you have to do some effort to get into deep meditations. No. So many people got their best meditation when they were least expecting it. No, I'm not going to tell that story again. But it's amazing, you know, just learning how to let go and not do something. So how do the deep meditations happen? With stillness, stopping. Okay, I usually tell this simile later on during the retreat, but because it fits in here. The donkey and the carrot simile. I do invent similes. This is my simile. I invented it, and I just mess around with it. So, how does a donkey pull a cart? There's two ways you can pull a cart. Oh, sorry. First of all, they try get that donkey, they tie the cart to the donkey, and they get out a stick, and they hit the donkey. Pull the cart, stupid donkey. And the donkeys refuse to pull a cart. They're very stubborn. We do have the phrase, as stubborn as a donkey. I don't know why they use all these similes for donkeys, but one other simile which they use, this was a Japanese monk who told me this simile when I was still a lay person. He told me, he said, yeah, you're a lay person, you want to go off and become a monk, that's a very good, but make sure you don't write any books. Because if you write a book, according to the Zen tradition, you will have to spend the next 7 rebirths as a donkey. I'm in big trouble. I've wrote too many books. That's many, 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 many lives as donkeys. So in the future, if you see a donkey, please be kind to them. That could be Ajahn Brahm. Anyway, this particular donkey story, if you hit the donkey doesn't move. You don't use the stick to hit the donkey. That's not kind, that's not Buddhist. You tie the stick to the donkey's neck, so the front of the stick is 2 feet in front of the donkey's mouth. On the end of the stick, you tie a string, and on the end of the string, you tie, if it's a Western donkey, a carrot. If it's from Singapore, a piece of durian. If it's from I don't know where else we people have from here. Something which the donkey likes. If it was from England, you'd tie a piece of fish and chips. I don't know how you could do that, but you get the message. So the English donkey sees this beautiful piece of fish and chips in front of its mouth. And what would the donkey do? It would move towards it. And when it moved towards it, the stick moves, the string moves, the fish and chips move. So that's how they keep the donkey pulling the cart. Never catches the fish and chips, never. So eventually the donkey, like Buddhism is getting very strong in UK now. That's one of the problems. I have to keep going on there giving talks all over the place. Anyway, so donkeys in England know how to catch the carrot now, or the fish and chips. So easy. Imagine this donkey has been running after the fish and chips, top speed, trying to get that piece of fish and chips. Nothing works. The fish and chips is always 2 feet in front of the donkey's mouth. So what does the donkey now do? Stops. Stop running. Stop striving. Take away your effort. Just stand there and have some confidence and faith in the Buddha's teachings. What happens to the fish and chips? He goes further and further and further away from the donkey. Further than it's ever been before in that donkey's hungry life. But then, fish and chips goes to 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. And then it stops and starts swinging back towards the donkey. And as it swings back towards the donkey, it's soon 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. But now coming at top speed towards the donkey's mouth. And all the donkey needs to do is to have that confidence. But an important part of Buddhism, which I'll emphasize so many times, is compassion. What does compassion mean? This is what compassion means. At the right time, when the fish and chips is just so close to the donkey's mouth, the donkey remembers compassion. Fish and chips, the door of my mouth is open to you. Otherwise it'll bounce off the teeth. That's how donkeys catch fish and chips. Durian, carrots, or whatever else you like to eat. So this is why silence, staying still, stopping this striving, just being here, relaxing to the max, letting things be, letting go. And it's amazing, it's such a simple thing to do. But no one's ever told you to do that anymore. So many people feel guilty. Well, if I can't get this wonderful peace and stillness, you know, through striving, I'm hopeless. You're not hopeless, you're just doing it the wrong way. Okay, this simile I usually tell every time. Yes. If you've heard these similes before, if you've heard these stories before, it's not my fault. It's your fault because you have the same problems. You haven't understood it yet. So anyway, how do I keep the glass of water perfectly still? Holding it will never keep it still. Of course, I'm not being mindful, am I? I'll be mindful now. It's moving. You know why? I'm not putting any effort in. I know effort, I'll concentrate. You made me laugh, it's moving much more. Many of you, this is how you meditate. Trying to hold your mind still. Have you ever achieved it yet? Any goals? You get close. It's not moving that much, but it never is actually still. And you soon get tired. You get sloth and torpor. How do you keep this water perfectly still with no effort? Let it go. Stop attaching. Put it down. Let it be. When I do that, it's still moving. Oh, now it's much better. It's not moving at all. There's no way in the world I could hold it still. When you let go, it becomes still all by itself. Do you get the message? Stop doing so much. You do find that when you become still, there's nothing much you can do. You're still. Even all these thoughts, I look at them these days. Some of those thoughts are very smart thoughts, a lot of them are stupid thoughts. A lot of those thoughts are jokes. That's why I think they're the most useful ones. At least they make people laugh. I was showing Venerable Bodhidharma this little cartoon from Gary Larson, which Venerable Mudu in Albany sent me today, about these policemen, detectives, that are going into this room, and there's all these dead cats in the room. And the policeman said, please, you know, deputy, have a look at all the lab equipment, all the books, and all the theories these cats have been writing on the blackboard. It just shows that curiosity killed the cats. I kind of like that one. Did I explain it well enough, Venerable Bodhi?
Yes, but I didn't see it.
Oh, I thought I showed you this evening. Someone else. Oh, it was this evening. Okay, I'll show it to you later on. But anyway, just keeping that happy mind is a beautiful way of starting a retreat. And that's how we keep the water. We're happy just to leave it alone and just watch it and how still it is. And after a while, all those thoughts you have in your mind, they're like waves on the surface of that water, which is your mind. And sometimes those waves are just like tsunami waves, huge, destroying things. Often they're just like ripples on the surface. But nothing is like when there's no waves at all on the surface of that water. And your mind is perfectly still and silent. If ever you see a body of water which is so still, especially at night time, then it reflects the moon and the stars like a glass mirror does, perfect with no distortion. Only through such stillness do you see things as they truly are. Or as the Buddha said, through samadhi, stillness, yathabhutayana dasanam, you see things as they truly are. When there's any thinking or movement, it distorts reality. You think you may see the truth, but you're seeing a distortion of it. That's one of the reasons why, with that stillness and peace, the mind becomes so still and quiet, you start to see the truth of things. All the wantings which you have, that's like the wind, which stirs up the surface of the lake and makes the waves and distorts reality. So that's why when we're silent, it's very hard to get wanting. It's very hard to get any ill will. You're too still. And please stay there as long as you can, in stillness, not wanting anything in the whole world. Happy just to be here. Content and easily satisfied, then you'll find your mind really wakes up. It gets energized, doesn't move. It's just like when, as a kid, I remember getting these magnifying glasses. Yeah, well, as a kid, there was sun sometimes in UK, and you put the magnifying glass, and the sun's rays would get focused, and you could burn a piece of grass or a piece of newspaper. That's just like what happens with the mind. When it gets still, it gets focused, it gets powerful, it gets joyful, and can see things so deeply. That's where the insight comes from stillness. Once the stillness is there, the insight gets so incredibly strong. The first day or two, it's quite easy to do this, especially because it's new. but always remember the joy of it. Then you won't get sort of kind of like some people, I can't understand why, but you get kind of bored. You know, you say, I can do this now, but then you just go back to old habits. But if that joy and happiness are strong, for your whole retreat you can enjoy peace and quiet and silence. You kind of wonder, why is it that people talk so much? Why do they think so much? Why do they do so much? What do you need to do in this world? Right now, you've got beautiful food, a comfortable place to stay. There's nothing really which is missing in this Jhana Grove retreat. You've got a place you can go for exercise, and I said, like just laying your back on the stupa, and then you can see these beautiful stars. See the animals flying through the air. Everything is just so easy here. So because of that, please enjoy. And just spend all the time just becoming really peaceful in your meditation. See what happens. Yeah, we do have schedules. I always like to mention this. Please do not keep the schedule. Instead, keep the kindness and the stillness. And by that I mean, I'm not sure what time you get up in the morning. First day, if you're tired, if you come from overseas, in different time zone, of course you're going to be tired. Look after your body, care for your body. And if you look after the body and care for the body, oh, there's one story, a lady in this retreat which I gave over in Sydney years ago, that she came in the middle of the night, even though she lived in Sydney, worked in Sydney, she came in just to report to me first thing in the morning, and she said she was still really tired. She's an executive, very successful woman, but she said she was still tired. So I told her, I almost ordered her. I said, listen, you are tired. After this little session, go back to bed, get up for lunch. After lunch, go back to bed again, and the following morning do the same. Don't come for the early morning chanting. Just come up for breakfast and lunch and that's all. I said, I can't do that. I said, I order you. And so she did it, good girl. And then after 2 or 3 days, she came in, because they were living in dormitories, not one person to a room. She came in and said, all the other girls in this dormitory, another 3 girls in the place where I was sleeping, they're looking at me with so much anger. And I said, it's not anger, it's jealousy. They wish they had the guts to do that, what you're doing. Carry on. And she did. She was sleep deprived, stressed out, poor lady. And after, only took 3 or 4 days. And after 3 or 4 days, her body felt so much better. She started getting up for the morning chanting, started meditating just like everybody else, a bit late in the evening. And then after those next 3 days, she's caught up with everybody else. And then after that 6 days, she had another 3 days to go. Now she was primed. She was meditating so much, and she became one of the star meditators on that retreat, having spent the first 3 days sleeping. And I always tell that story. You've got to know your body, be kind to it, work with it. Don't say you know better, you're going to train the body. Don't try that. Understand the body, be kind to it, look after it, and then you find your body will look after you. So as far as the schedules are concerned, if you wish to get up early tomorrow morning, fine. If you don't, fine. I'm not going to go to your room and drag you out of bed. I'm not going to knock on the door, come on! I don't need to set your alarm clock because you know the time of breakfast. The other times you might not know the time to get up for the chanting, but you certainly know when breakfast time is. If you haven't eaten the night before, you know what time lunch is. It's amazing. Just if you go to Bodhinyana Monastery, all the birds, they know what time lunch is. And I've never seen one of those parrots or kookaburras. I've never seen any one of those with a watch. But they know when lunch is. So you will too, so don't worry about that. And then when it's time to meditate, just when you feel like meditating, sit down and meditate and enjoy it. Walking meditation, sitting meditation. How long should you walk for? How long should you sit for? However long it feels is the right time. That's why we have the sitting meditation, the walking meditation halls right next to the sitting meditation place. So it's easy to just walk into one of those rooms and do some walking meditation. The two in the side and one in the back. And when you feel a bit tired and you feel this is enough for now, you go back and sit meditation. It's nice and simple and easy. And you keep on building it up, the peace, you know, the stillness, the comfort, the relaxing to the maxness. And then you find the meditation just happens. The cup becomes still, not because I make it still, because I let it be still. And then you have these beautiful meditations. And you find just how easy it is to enjoy meditation. Because you're given the freedom. And honestly, I hope this happens, this retreat, as most retreats it happens. If you're having a beautiful meditation before lunchtime. What time is the lunch? Is it 11 o'clock? So 10 to 11, your meditation's really nice. Stay here. You don't need to eat. I mean that, because you enjoy the meditation so much, you don't need it. Don't waste the opportunity for deep meditation by wanting to eat. You can have some extra food later on. And if you just had a deep meditation, a really good meditation, and you really are hungry, you can come and see me, and I'll just talk with Nadia to get you some food somehow or other, because you deserve it. Had a nice meditation. I don't want you to stop the opportunity having deep meditation because you're worried about lunch. Is that okay, Nadia? Very good, excellent. So, and people do that. They have beautiful meditations, not all the time, but sometimes. And that's a wonderful thing to do. So remember, you're here for the meditation, not to keep all the times. Be silent, no. Just keep as many rules as you can. And I don't know why we call them rules. Look, I'm a monk. I've been keeping rules for such a long time, but the rules aren't... I don't really feel they're rules anymore. They're just like simple ways of living, easy ways of living. You wonder why anyone would want to break one of these rules. They don't feel like a rule anymore, just a beautiful, peaceful way of life. So please contemplate them and try and keep them as the good ones as best you possibly can. Be silent. Have a wonderful time. But I do also ask you, I was going to say, please don't get enlightened in the first couple of days. The reason I say that is because you get enlightened in the first couple of days, what the heck are you going to do for the rest of the time? You probably be, I can talk now, I can do whatever I want, you'll probably spoil it for everybody else. So anyway, that's typical Ajahn Brahm being silly. So thank you all for listening, and that's just a taste of what's to come next. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Okay, I wish you a happy evening. If you want to carry on meditating, please do. Want to go back, please do. Don't wait for me to go out before you go out, because I sometimes, like this evening, I feel energized, so I want to go and meditate a few more minutes. Oh, I should have said also, if you don't like meditating in here, it's a bit cold or noisy or whatever, please make use of your own rooms. You've got some solitude. This is a rare retreat centre where everybody has their own room with their own ensuite. So hopefully that's nice and comfortable for you. So if you want to meditate in there for hours, just go for it. Easy. Okay, have a good evening.